eyes burning, whipped her head in a circle, the motion boneless, unnerving. Too many tendrils for me to count lanced across the room and slammed into Francisca Garcia's belly, thrusting like knives. She let out a choking gasp and stared down at her wounds as several more tendrils thrust through her. They made a thunking sound as they hit the wooden wall of the cabin. The demon laughed. It was a quick, breathless, excited laugh, the kind you expect from a nervous teenage girl. Her face twisted into a feral smile, showing a mouthful of metallic-seeming teeth, and both sets of eyes glowed brightly. Francisca whispered, "Oh, my Gaston!" Then her head bowed, dark hair falling about her face in a veil, and her body relaxed. The demon shivered, and the tendril blades whipped out of her, the last foot or so of each soaked in scarlet. The tendrils lashed about in a sort of mad excitement, and more droplets of blood appeared everywhere. Francisca slumped down to the floor, blood beginning to soak her dress, and fell limply onto her side. Then the Denarian's two sets of eyes turned to me, and a swarm of razor-edged tendrils of her hair came whipping toward me. I had already begun to ready my shield, but when I saw Francisca fall, a surge of fury went coursing through me, filling me from toes to teeth with scarlet rage. The shield came together before me in a quarter dome of blazing crimson energy, and the writhing tendrils slammed against it in a dozen flashes of white light. The Denarian shrieked, jerking back, and the attacking tendrils went sailing back across the cabin with their ends scorched and blackened. I looked around wildly for my blasting rod, but it wasn't where Anna had left it when she took it from me. The pepper spray was, though. I grabbed it and faced the Denarian in time to see her raise her clawed hand. A shimmer in the air around her fingers threw off a prismatic flash of color, and with a flash of light from the upper set of eyes, the demoness drove her fist at my shield. She hit the shield hard, and she was incredibly strong. The blow drove me back against a wall, and when the heat shimmer of power touched my scarlet shield, it fractured into shards of light that went flying around the cabin like the sparks from a campfire. I tried to get to one side, away from the demon's vicious strength, but she snarled and strands of hair punched into the hull on either side of me, caging me. The Denarian reached for me with her claws. I shouted a panicked battle cry and gave her the pepper spray, full in the face, right into both sets of eyes. The demoness screamed again, twisting her face away, ruining the tendril cage, the human eyes squeezing shut over a sudden flood of tears. The glowing demon eyes did not even blink, and a sweep of the Denarian's arm fetched me a backhanded blow that sent me sprawling and made me see stars. I got back to my feet, terrified at the notion of being caught helpless on the ground. The Denarian seemed able to blow off my magic with a bit of effort, and she was deadly in these confined quarters. I didn't think I could get up the stairs without her tearing me apart, which meant I had to find another way to get the demon away. The Denarian swiped a clawed hand at her eyes and snarled in mangled, throaty English, "You will pay for that." I looked up to see that Anna had dragged herself across the floor to the fallen Francisca and knelt over her, shielding the other woman from the Denarian with her body. Her face was white with pain, or shock, or both, but she shot me a glance and then jerked her head toward the far side of the cabin. I followed her gaze and got her drift. As the Denarian recovered and blinked watery, murderous eyes at me, I lunged toward the far side of the room and shouted, "Get it out of the fridge! They must not have it!" The Denarian spat out what I took to be an oath, and I felt that lion-like foot land in the middle of my back, flattening me to the floor, claws digging into my skin. She stepped over me, past me, and her tendrils tore open the real fridge, taking the door from its hinges before slithering inside and knocking everything within to the floor. She hadn't quite finished with the first fridge before her hair had gone on to tear open the dummy fridge and dragged out the steel strongbox. While the Denarian did that, I looked wildly around the cabin and spotted my blasting rod on the floor. I rolled, my back burning with pain, and grabbed the blasting rod. Calling up fire within the tiny cabin was a bad idea, but waiting around for the Denarian to murder me with her hairdo was even worse. She stood up with the strong box just as I began channeling energy into the blasting rod. Its carved runes began to burn with golden radiance, and the tip of the rod suddenly gleamed with red light and wavered with hot air shimmer. The Denarian crouched, demonic limbs too long, feminine shape disturbingly attractive, red light gleaming on her metallic green scales. Her hair writhed in a hissing mass, striking sparks as one edge rasped against another. Violent lust burned in both sets of eyes for a second, and then she turned away. Her hair tore the cabin ceiling apart like paper mache, and using her hair, an arm, and one long leg, she swarmed out of the ship's cabin. I heard a splash as she hit the water, taking the strongbox with her. "What was that?" stammered Anna Valmont, clutching Francisca's limp form to her. "What the bloody hell was that?" I didn't drop the blasting rod or look away from the hole in the roof, because I didn't think the Denarian was the sort to leave a lot of people alive behind her. The end of the blasting rod was wavering, drunkenly. "How is she?" I watched the hole in the ceiling for several shaking breaths until Anna said, her voice barely audible, "She's gone." A stabbing feeling went through my belly, sharp and hot. Maybe I'm some kind of Neanderthal for thinking so, but it hurt me. A minute ago, Francisca Garcia had been talking, planning, grieving, breathing, living. She'd been killed by violence, and I couldn't stand the thought of things like that happening to a woman. It wouldn't have been any less wrong had it happened to a man, but in my gut, it wasn't the same. "Damn it," I whispered. "How are you? Can you walk?" Before she could answer, the ship lurched and leaned to one side. There was a wrenching, snapping roar and the rushing sound of water. Icy cold ran over my ankles and began to rise. "The hull's breached," Anna said. "We're taking on water." I headed for the stairway, blasting rod up to make sure it was clear. "Can you get out?" Light exploded behind my eyes, and I dropped to my hands and knees at the bottom of the stairway. Anna had slugged me with something. A second burst of light and pain drove my head far enough down to splash some cold water against my forehead. I dimly saw Anna's foot kick my blasting rod away from me. Then she picked up the shroud and its package from the counter and tore off the top sheet of the hotel memo pad. I saw that she had blood on her jacket soaked through and staining her fatigue pants down to the top of her left leg. She grabbed my coat, wincing, and one of the duffel bags. She put my leather duster on, covering the blood. The water had filled the cabin almost to the tops of her combat boots. I tried to get my wits together, but something was keeping me from doing much besides focusing my eyes. I knew that I needed to leave, but I couldn't get the message from my head to my arms and legs. Anna Valmont stepped past me and went up the stairs. She stopped about halfway up, spat out another curse, and came back down them enough to reach down and splash cold water into my face. The shock jump-started something in my body, and I coughed, my head spinning, and started to move again. I'd been too drunk to stand up a time or two, but even then I'd been more capable than I was at that moment. The blonde thief grabbed my arm and half-hauled me up a couple of stairs, her face twisted in pain. I desperately held on to that momentum, struggling up another stair even after she stopped pulling. She kept going up the stairs and didn't look back as she said, "I'm only doing this because I like your coat, Dresden. Don't come near me again." Then she padded up out of the cabin and disappeared with the shroud. My head had started to throb and swell, but it was clearing rapidly also. But evidently I wasn't all that bright, even when fully conscious, because I staggered back down into the ship's cabin. Francisca Garcia's corpse had fallen onto its side, glassy eyes staring, mouth slightly open. One of her cheeks had been half-covered by water. There were still tracks of tears on the other one. The water around her was a cloudy, brownish pink. My stomach heaved, and the anger that came with it nearly sent me to the floor again. Instead, I sloshed through the freezing water to the counter. I picked up the cell phone there and the blank memo pad. I hesitated over Francisca. She didn't deserve to have her body swallowed by the lake like a discarded beer bottle. My balance wobbled again. The water had begun to rise more quickly. It covered my shins already, and I couldn't feel my feet for the cold. I tried to lift her body, but the effort brought a surge of pain to my head, and I almost threw up. I settled the body back down, unable to even curse coherently, and made do with gently closing her eyes with one hand. It was all I could do for her. The police would find her, of course, probably within a few hours. And if I didn't get moving, they'd find me, too. I couldn't afford to spend a night in the pokey while I was interrogated, charged, and awaiting bail, but what else was new? I'd get in touch with Murphy as soon as I could. I folded my arms against the growing cold, hugging the memo pad and cell phone to my chest, and slogged out of the bloody water of the étranger's cabin and onto the deck. I had to make a short jump up to the dock. A couple of people were on the sidewalk above the little harbor, staring down, and I saw a couple of folks out on the decks of their ships, also staring. I ducked my head, thought inconspicuous thoughts, and hurried away before my morning could get any worse. Chapter 14. I've been clouted in the head a few times in my day. The bump Anna Valmont had given me was smaller than some, but my head pounded all the way home. At least my stomach settled down before I started throwing up all over myself. I shambled in, washed down a couple of Tylenol with a can of Coke, and folded some ice into a towel. I sat down by the phone, put the ice pack against the back of my head, and called Father Vincent. The phone rang once.
"Yes?"
"It's in town," I said. "The two church mice had it on a boat in Burnham Harbor." Vincent's voice gained an edge of tension.
"You have it?"
I said, "not strictly speaking, no. Something went wrong."
"What happened?"
he demanded, his voice growing more frustrated, angrier.
"Why didn't you call me?"
"A third party made a grab for it, and what do you think I'm doing right now? I had a shot to recover the thing. I took it. I missed."
"And the shroud was taken from the thieves?"
"Thief, singular. Chicago PD is probably recovering the body of her partner right now."
"They turned on each other?"
"Not even. A new player killed Garcia. Valmont duped the third party into taking a decoy, and she grabbed the real McCoy and ran."
"And you didn't see fit to follow her?"
My head pounded steadily. "She ran really fast." Vincent was silent for a moment before he said,
"So the shroud is lost to us once more."
"For now," I said. "I might have another lead."
"You know where it has gone?"
I took in a deep breath and tried to sound patient. "Not yet. That's why it's called a lead and not a solution. I need that sample of the shroud."
"To be frank, Mr. Dresden, I did bring a few threads with me from the Vatican, but..."
"Great. Get one of them to my office and drop it off with the security downstairs. They'll hold it for me until I can pick it up. I'll call you as soon as I have anything more definite."
"But..."
I hung up on Vincent and felt a twinge of vindictive satisfaction.
"You didn't see a fit to follow her,"
I muttered to Mister, doing my best to imitate Vincent's accent. "I got you didn't see fit to follow her, white-collar jerk. How about I ring your bell a few times and then you can go say mass or something?" Mister gave me a look as if to say that I shouldn't say such things about paying clients. I glared at him to let him know that I was well aware of it, got up, went into my bedroom, and rummaged in my closet until I found a stick of charcoal and a clipboard. Then I lit several candles on the end table next to my big comfy chair and settled down with the memo pad I'd taken from the étranger. I brushed the stick of charcoal over it as carefully as I could and hoped that Francisca Garcia hadn't been using a felt tip. She hadn't. Faint white letters began to appear amidst the charcoal on the paper. It read Marriott on the first line and 2345 on the second. I frowned down at the pad. Marriott. One of the hotels? It could have been someone's last name, too. Or maybe some kind of French word. No, don't make it more complicated than it has to be, Harry. It probably meant the hotel. The number appeared to be military time for a quarter to midnight, maybe even a room number. I glared at the note. It didn't tell me enough. Even though I may have had the time and place, I didn't know where and when. I looked at the cell phone I'd taken. I knew as much about cell phones as I did about gastrointestinal surgery, There were no markings on the case, not even a brand name. The phone was off, but I didn't dare turn it on. It would probably stop working. Hell, it would probably explode. I would need to ask Murphy to see what she could find out when I talked to her. My head kept pounding, and my eyes itched with weariness. I needed rest. The lack of sleep was making me sloppy. I shouldn't have chanced going on to the ship in the first place, and I should have been more careful about watching my back. I'd had a gut instinct someone was watching me, but I'd been too tired, too impatient, and I'd nearly gotten myself shot, impaled, concussed, and drowned as a result. I headed into the bedroom, set my alarm clock for a couple hours after noon, and flopped down on my bed. It felt obscenely good. Naturally, it didn't last. The phone rang, and I gave serious thought to blasting it into orbit, where it could hang around with asteroid Dresden. I stomped back into the living room, picked up the phone, and snarled, "What?"
Oh, said a somewhat nervous voice on the other end. "This is Waldo Butters. I was calling to speak to Harry Dresden."
I moderated my voice to a mere snarl. "Oh, hey."
"I woke you up, huh?"
"Some."
"Yeah, late nights suck. Look, there's something odd going on, and I thought maybe I could ask you something."
"Sure."
"Sullen monosyllabism. A sure sign of sleep deprivation."
"Huh?"
"Now descending into formless vocalization. My time is short."
Butters cleared his throat and said,
"The germs are gone."
"Germs?" I asked.
"In the samples I took from that body. I ran all the checks again just to be sure, and better than half of them turned up negative. Nothing. Zip. Zero."
I said.
"Okay then, caveman Og. Where germs go?"
"Sunrise," I said. "Poof." Butter's voice sounded bewildered.
"Vampire germs?"
"The tiny capes are a dead giveaway," I said. I started pulling my train of thought into motion at last. "Not vampire germs. Constructs. See, at sunrise it's like the whole magical world gets reset to zero. New beginnings. Most spells don't hold together through even one sunrise, and it takes a lot to make them last through two or three."
"Magic germs?" Butters asked. "Are you telling me I've got magic germs?"
"Magic germs," I confirmed. "Someone called them up with magic."
"Like an actual magic spell?"
"Usually you call nasty, hurtful spells a curse. But by tomorrow or the next day, those other samples will probably have zeroed out too."
"Are they still infectious?"
"Assume they are. They're good as real until the energy that holds them together falls apart."
"Christ. You're serious? It's for real?"
"Well, yeah."
"Is there a book or a Cliff's Notes or something on this stuff?"
I actually smiled that time. "Just me. Anything else?"
"Not much. I swept the body for genetic remains, but got nothing. The cuts on the corpse were made with either a surgical scalpel or some other kind of small, fine blade. Maybe a utility knife."
"I've seen cuts like that before, yeah."
"Here's the best part. The same blade evidently took off the hands and head. The cuts are cleaner than a surgeon could manage on an operating table. 3 single cuts. The heat from it half cauterized parts of the wounds. So, what kind of tool can cut fine, precise lines and cleave through bones, too?"
"Sword?"
"Have to be one hell of a sharp sword."
"There's a few around like that. Any luck identifying the victim?"
"None, sorry."
"It's okay."
"You want to know if anything changes?"
"Yeah, or if you see anyone else come in like that guy."
"God forbid. Will do. You find anything on that tattoo?"
"Called the Eye of Thoth," I said, trying to narrow down exactly who uses it around here. "Oh, give Murphy a call. Let her know about those samples."
"Already did. She's the one who told me to keep you in the loop. I think she was heading towards sleep, too. Would she want me to wake her up to talk to you?"
I talked through a yawn.
"Nah, it can wait. Thanks for the call, Butters."
"No trouble," he said. "Sleep is God. Go worship."
I grunted, hung up the phone, and didn't get to take the second step toward my bed when someone knocked at the door. "I need one of those trap doors," I muttered to Mister. I could push a button and people would fall screaming down a wacky slide thing and land in mud somewhere. Mister was far too mature to dignify that with a response, so I kept a hand near my gift rack as I opened the door a crack and peeked out. Susan tilted her head sideways and gave me a small smile. She was wearing jeans, an old tee, a heavy gray fleece jacket, and sunglasses. "Hi," she said.
"Hi."
"You know, it's hard to tell through the door, but your eyes look sunken and bloodshot. Did you sleep last night?"
"What is this thing you speak of, sleep?"
Susan sighed and shook her head. "Mind if I come in?" I stepped back and opened the door wider. No scolding. Susan came in and folded her arms. "Always so cold in here in the winter." I had a couple suggestions on how to warm up, but I didn't say them out loud. Maybe I didn't want to see her response to them. I thought about what Murphy had said about setting up a talk. I got some more wood and stirred up the fireplace. "Want me to make some tea or something?" She shook her head. "No." Susan never turned down a cup of hot tea. I tried, but I couldn't keep a hard edge out of my voice. "Just going to dump me and run, then. Drive by dumping."
"Harry, that isn't fair," Susan said.
I could hear the hurt in her voice, but only barely. I raked harder at the fire, making sparks fly up, though flames were already licking the new wood.
"This isn't easy for anyone."
My mouth kept running without checking in with my brain. My heart, maybe, but not my brain. I shot her a look over my shoulder and said, "Except for Captain Mediocrity, I guess." She raised both eyebrows.
"Do you mean Martin?"
"Isn't that what this is about?" A spark flipped out of the fire and landed on my hand, stinging. I yelped and pulled my hand away. I closed the heavy mesh curtain over the fire and put the poker away.
"And before you say anything, I know damn well I'm being insane. And possessive. I know that we were quits before you left town. It's been more than a year, and it's been hard on you. It's only natural for you to find someone. It's irrational and childish for me to be upset, and I don't care."
"Harry," she began.
"And it's not as if you hadn't been thinking about it," I continued. Somewhere I knew that I'd start choking on my foot if I kept shoving it in my mouth.
"You kissed me. You kissed me, Susan. I know you. You meant it.
This isn't..."
"I bet you don't kiss Snoozy Martin like that." Susan rolled her eyes and walked to me. She sat down on the lintel of my little fireplace while I knelt before it. She cupped my cheek in one hand. She was warm. It felt good. I was too tired to control my reaction to the simple, gentle touch, and I looked back at the fire.
"Harry," she said, "you're right. I don't kiss Martin like that."
I pulled my cheek away, but she put her fingers on my chin and tugged my face back toward her.
"I don't kiss him at all. I'm not involved with Martin."
I blinked.
"You're not?"
She drew an invisible X over her heart with her index finger.
"Oh," I said. I felt my shoulders ease up a little.
Susan laughed.
"Was that really worrying you, Harry? That I was leaving you for another man?"
"I don't know, I guess."
"God, you are adult sometimes."
She smiled at me, but I could see the sadness in it.
"It always shocked me how you could understand so many things and be such a complete idiot about so many others."
"Practice," I said. She looked down at me for a while with that same sad smile, and I understood. "It doesn't change anything, does it?"
"Martin?"
"Yeah." She nodded.
"It doesn't change anything."
I swallowed, a sudden frog in my throat.
"You want it to be over." "I don't want it," she said quickly, "but I think it's necessary for both of us."
"You came back here to tell me that?" Susan shook her head.
"I don't have my mind set. I think it wouldn't be fair to do that without talking to you about it. We both have to make this decision."
I growled and looked back at the fire. "Would be a lot simpler if you just gave me the Dear John speech and left."
"Simpler," she said. "Easier. but not fair and not right. I didn't say anything. I've changed, Susan said. Not just the vampire thing. There's a lot that's been happening in my life. A lot of things that I didn't know.
Like what?
How dangerous the world is, for one, she said. I wound up in Peru, but I went all over South America, Central America. I couldn't have imagined what things are like there. Harry, the Red Court is everywhere. There are whole villages out in the country supporting groups of them. Like cattle bred for the Lord of the Manor. The vampires feed on everyone, addict them all. Her voice hardened. Even the children.
My stomach twitched unpleasantly. I had never heard that.
Not many know.
I mopped a hand over my face.
God, kids. I want to help, to do something. I found where I can help down there, Harry. A job. I'm going to take it.
Something in my chest hurt, a literal pain. I thought this was our decision.
I'm coming to that, she said.
I nodded. Okay.
She slipped to the floor next to me and said, You could come with me.
Go with her. Leave Chicago. Leave Murphy, the Alphas, Michael. Leave a horde of problems, many of them ones I'd created for myself. I thought of packing up and heading out. Maybe fighting the good fight. Being loved again. Held again. God, I wanted that. But people would get hurt. Friends. Others who might be in my kind of danger and have no one to turn to. I looked into Susan's eyes and saw hope there for just a moment. Then understanding. She smiled, but it was somehow sadder than ever. Susan, I said. She pressed a finger to my lips and blinked back tears.
I know.
And then I understood. She knew because she was feeling the same way. There are things you can't walk away from, not if you want to live with yourself afterward.
Now, do you understand? She asked.
I nodded, but my voice came out rough. Wouldn't be fair. Not to either of us, I said. Not being together. Both of us hurting. Susan leaned her shoulder against mine and nodded. I put my arm around her. Maybe someday things will change, I said.
Maybe someday, she agreed. I love you. I never stopped loving you, Harry.
Yeah, I said. I choked on the end of the word, and the fire went blurry. I love you too, damn it. We sat there and warmed up in front of the fire for a couple of minutes before I said,
When are you leaving?
Tomorrow, she said. With Martin? She nodded.
He's a co-worker. He's helping me move, watching my back. I have to put everything in order here, pack some things from the apartment.
What kind of work?
Pretty much the same kind. Investigate and report. Only I report to a boss instead of to readers.
She sighed and said,
I'm not supposed to tell you anything else about it.
Hell's bells, I muttered. Will I be able to reach you? She nodded.
I'll set up a drop. You can write. I'd like that.
Yeah, stay in touch. Long minutes after that, Susan said,
You're on a case again, aren't you?
Does it show? She leaned a little away from me, and I drew my arm back.
I smelled it, she said, and stood up to add wood to the fire. There's blood on you.
Yeah, I said. A woman was killed about 5 feet away from me.
Vampires? Susan asked. I shook my head. Some kind of demon. Are you okay?
Peachy.
That's funny, because you look like hell, Susan said.
I said no scolding. She almost smiled.
You'd be smart to get some sleep.
True, but I'm not all that bright, I said. Besides, I didn't have a prayer of falling asleep now, after talking to her.
Ah, she said. Is there anything I can do to help?
Don't think so.
You need rest.
I waved a hand at the stationary pad. I will. I just have to run down a lead first. Susan folded her arms, facing me directly.
So do it after you get some rest. There probably isn't time. Susan frowned and picked up the pad.
Marriott, the hotel?
Don't know, likely.
What are you looking for?
I sighed, too tired to stick to my confidentiality guns very closely. Stolen artifact. I think the note is probably about a site for the sale.
Who is the buyer?
I shrugged.
Lots of legwork, then.
Yeah. Susan nodded.
Let me look into this. You get some sleep.
It's probably better if you don't. She waved a hand, cutting me off.
I want to help. Let me do this for you.
I opened my mouth and closed it again. I guess I could relate. I knew how much I'd wanted to help her. I couldn't. It had been tough to handle. It would have been a relief to me to have done her some good, no matter how small it was. All right, I said, but just the phone work, okay?
Okay.
She copied down the word and the number on a sheet she tore from the bottom of the memo pad and turned toward the door.
Susan,
I said. She paused without turning to look back at me. Do you want to get dinner or something? Before you go, I mean, I want to, you know.
Say goodbye? She said quietly.
Yeah.
All right.
She left. I sat in my apartment in front of the fire and breathed in the scent of her perfume. I felt cold, lonely, and tired. I felt like a hollowed-out husk. I felt as if I had failed her, failed to protect her to begin with, failed to cure her after the vampires had changed her.
Change. Maybe that's what this was really about.
Susan had changed. She'd grown. She was more relaxed than I remembered, more confident. There had always been a sense of purpose to her, but now it seemed deeper somehow. She'd found a place for herself, somewhere where she felt she could do some good. Maybe I should have gone with her after all. But no. Part of the change was that she felt hungrier now, too. More quietly sensual, as if every sight and sound and touch in the room was occupying most of her attention. She'd smelled drops of blood on my clothing, and it had excited her enough to make her move away from me. Another change. She had an instinctive hunger for my blood. And she could throw vampires 20 feet through the air. She sure as hell wouldn't have any trouble tearing my throat out in an intimate moment if her control slipped. I washed my face mechanically, showered in my unheated shower, and went shivering to my bed. The routine hadn't helped me. It only delayed me from facing the harshest truth of my relationship with Susan. She had left Chicago. Probably for good. That was going to hurt like hell in the morning. Chapter 15. I had bad dreams. They were the usual fare. Flames devoured someone who screamed my name. A pretty girl spread her arms, eyes closed, and fell slowly backward as dozens of fine cuts opened all over her skin. The air became a fine pink spray. I turned from it into a kiss with Susan, who drew me down and tore out my throat with her teeth. A woman who seemed familiar, but whom I did not recognize, shook her head and drew her hand from left to right. The dream scenery faded to black in the wake of her motion. She turned to me, dark eyes intent, and said, "You need to rest." Mickey Mouse woke me up, my alarm jangling noisily, his little hand on 2 and the big hand on 12. I wanted to smack the clock for waking me up, but I reined in the impulse. I'm not against a little creative violence now and then, but you have to draw the line somewhere. I wouldn't sleep in the same room with a person who would smack Mickey Mouse. I got up, got dressed, left a message for Murphy, another for Michael, fed Mister, and hit the road. Michael's house did not blend in with most of the other homes in his neighborhood west of Wrigley Field. It had a white picket fence. It had elegant window dressings. It had a tidy front lawn that was always green, even in the midst of a blazing Chicago summer. It had a few shady trees, a lot of well-kept shrubberies, and if I had found a couple of deer grazing on the lawn or drinking from the bird bath, it wouldn't have surprised me. I got out of the Beetle, holding my blasting rod loosely in my right hand. I opened the gate, and a few jingle bells hanging on a string tinkled happily. The gate swung shut on a lazy spring behind me. I knocked on the front door and waited, but no one answered. I frowned. Michael's house had never been empty before. Charity had at least a couple of kids who weren't old enough to be in school yet, including the poor little guy they'd named after me, Harry Carpenter. How cruel is that? I frowned at the cloud-hazed sun. Weren't the older kids getting out of school shortly? Charity had some kind of maternal obsession with never allowing her kids to come home to an empty house. Someone should have been there. I got a sick, twisty feeling in the pit of my stomach. I knocked again, put my ear against the door, and listened. I could hear the slow tick of the old grandfather clock in the front room. The heater cycled on for a moment, and the vents inside whispered. There were a few sounds when a bit of breeze touched the house, the creaks of old and comfortable wood. Nothing else. I tried the front door. It was locked. I stepped back off the porch and followed the narrow driveway to the back of the property. If the front of the carpenter's home would have qualified for Better Homes and Gardens, the back would have been fit for a Craftsman commercial. The large tree centered on the back lawn cast lots of shade in the summer, but with the leaves gone, I could see the fortress-like treehouse Michael had built for his kids in it. It had finished walls, an actual window, and guardrails anywhere anyone could possibly have thought about falling. The treehouse had a porch that overlooked the yard. Hell, I didn't have a porch. It's an unfair world. A big section of the yard had been bitten off by an addition connected to the back of the house. The foundation had been laid, and there were wooden beams framing what would eventually be walls. Heavy contractor's plastic had been stapled to the wooden studs to keep the wind off the addition. The separate garage was closed, and a peek in the window showed me that it was pretty well filled with lumber and other construction materials. "No cars," I muttered. "Maybe they went to McDonald's or a church. Do they have church at 3 in the afternoon? I turned around to go back to the Beetle. I'd leave Michael a note. My stomach fluttered. If I didn't get a second for the duel, it was likely to be a bad evening. Maybe I should ask Bob to be my second. Or maybe Mister. No one dares to mess with Mister. Something rattled against the metal gutters running the length of the back of the house. I jumped like a spooked horse and scrambled away from the house toward the garage at the back of the yard so I could get a look at the roof. Given that in the past day or so, no less than 3 different parties had taken a poke at me, I felt totally justified in being on edge. I got to the back of the yard but couldn't see the whole roof from there, so I clambered up into the branches, then took a 6-foot ladder up to the main platform of the treehouse. From there, I could see that the roof was empty. I heard brisk, somewhat heavy footsteps below me and beyond the fence at the back of the little yard. I froze in place in the treehouse, listening. The heavy footsteps padded up to the fence at the back of the yard, and I heard the scrape of chain link dragging against dry leaves and other late winter detritus. I heard a muted grunt of effort and a long exhalation. Then the footsteps came to the base of the tree. Leather scraped against a wooden step, and the tree shivered almost imperceptibly. Someone was climbing up. I looked around me, but the ladder was the only way down, unless I felt like jumping. It couldn't have been more than 9 or 10 feet down. Odds were I could land more or less in one piece, but if I misjudged the jump, I could sprain an ankle or break a leg, which would make running away both impractical and embarrassing. Jumping would have to be a last resort. I gathered in my will and settled my grip on my blasting rod, pointing it directly at where the ladder met the platform. The tip of the blasting rod glowed with a pinpoint of bright red energy. Blonde hair and the top half of a girl's angelic young face appeared at the top of the ladder. There was a quiet gasp, and her blue eyes widened. "Holy crap!" I jerked the tip of the blasting rod up and away from the girl, releasing the gathered energy. "Molly?" The rest of the girl's face appeared as she climbed on up the ladder. "Wow, is that an acetylene torch or something?" I blinked and peered more closely at Molly. "Is that an earring in your eyebrow?" The girl clapped her fingers over her right eyebrow.
And your nose?
Molly shot a furtive look over her shoulder at the house and scrambled the rest of the way up to the treehouse. As tall as her mother, Molly was all coltish legs and long arms. She wore a typical private school uniform of skirt, blouse, and sweater, but it looked like she'd been attacked by a lech with razor blades where fingers should have been. The skirt was essentially slashed to ribbons, and underneath it she wore black tights, also torn to nigh indecency. Her shirt and sweater had apparently endured the blitz, but the bright red satin bra that peeked out from beneath looked new. She had on too much makeup. Not as bad as most kids too old to play tag but too young to drive, but it was there. She wore a ring of fine gold wire through one pale gold eyebrow, and a golden stud protruded from one side of her nose. I worked hard not to smile. Smiling would have implied that I found her outfit amusing. She was young enough to be hurt by that kind of opinion, and I had a vague memory of being that ridiculous at one time. Let he who hath never worn parachute pants cast the first stone. Molly clambered in and tossed a bulging backpack down on the wooden floor.
You lurk in tree houses a lot, Mr. Dresden?
I'm looking for your dad. Molly wrinkled up her nose, then started removing the stud from it. I didn't want to watch.
I don't want to tell you how to investigate stuff, but generally speaking, you won't find him in tree houses.
I came over, but no one answered the door when I knocked. Is that normal? Molly took out the eyebrow ring, dumped the backpack out onto the floorboards, and started sorting out a long skirt with a floral print, a t-shirt, and a sweater.
It is on errands day. Mom loads up the sandcrawler with all the little snot-nosed Jawas and goes all over town.
Oh, do you know when she's due back?
Any time, Molly said.
She hopped into the skirt and wriggled out of the tattered skirt and tights in that mystifyingly modest way that girls always seem to manage to acquire sometime in their teens. The shirt and pink sweater went on next, and the ripped-up sweater and, to my discomfort, the bright red bra came out from under the conservative clothes and got tucked back into the backpack. I turned my back on the girl as well as I could in the limited space. The link of handcuff Anna Valmont had slapped onto my wrist chafed and pinched. I scratched at it irritably. You'd think I'd been cuffed enough times that I should have gotten myself a key by now. Molly took a wet wipe from somewhere and started peeling the makeup from her face.
Hey, she asked a minute later, what's wrong?
I grunted and waved my wrist vaguely, swinging the cuff around.
Hey, neat, Molly said. Are you on the lam? Is that why you're hiding in a treehouse, so the cops won't find you?
No, I said. It's kind of a long story.
Oh, Molly said wisely. Those are fun-time handcuffs, not bad-time handcuffs. I gotcha.
No, I protested. And how the hell would you know about fun-time handcuffs anyway? You're like 10, she snorted.
14.
Whatever, too young.
Internet, she said sagely. Expanding the frontiers of adolescent knowledge.
God, I'm old. Molly clucked and dipped into the backpack again. She grabbed my wrist firmly, shook out a ring of small keys, and started trying them in the lock of the cuffs.
So, give me the juicy details, she said. You can say bleep instead of the fun words if you want.
I blinked. Where the bleep did you get a bunch of cuff keys? She looked up at me and narrowed her eyes.
Think about this one. Do you really want to know?
I sighed. No, probably not.
Cool, she said, and turned her attention back to the cuffs. So, stop dodging the issue. What's up with you and Susan?
Why do you want to know?
I like romance. Plus, I heard Mom say that you two were a pretty hot item.
Your mom said that? Molly shrugged.
Sorta. As much as she ever would. She used words like fornication and sin and infantile depravity and moral bankruptcy. So are you?
Morally bankrupt?
A hot item with Susan.
I shrugged and said, not anymore.
Don't move your wrist.
Molly fiddled with one key for a moment before discarding it.
What happened?
A lot, I said. It's complicated.
Oh,
Molly said. The cuffs clicked and loosened and she beamed up at me.
There.
Thanks. I rubbed my sore wrist and put the cuffs in my coat pocket. Molly bent over and picked up a piece of paper. She read it and said, "Ask Michael about Duel? Whiskey and tobacco?"
"It's a shopping list."
Molly frowned. "Oh." She was quiet for a moment and then asked, "So, was it the vampire thing?"
I blinked at the girl again.
"Was there a PBS special or something? Is there some kind of unauthorized biography of my life? I snuck downstairs so I could listen to Dad tell Mom what had happened."
"Do you eavesdrop on every private conversation you can?"
She rolled her eyes and sat down on the edge of the platform, her shoes waving in the air. "No one says anything interesting in a public conversation, do they? Why did you guys split up?"
I sat down next to her. "Like I said, it was complicated."
"Complicated how?"
I shrugged.
"Her condition gives her an impulse control problem," I said. "She told me that strong emotions and other feelings are dangerous for her. She could lose control and hurt someone."
"Oh," Molly said, and scrunched up her nose again.
"So you can't make a play for her, or..."
"Bad things could happen, and then she'd be a full vampire."
"But you both want to be together?" Molly asked.
"Yeah," she frowned.
"God, that's sad. You want to be with her, but the sex part..."
I shuddered. "You are far too young to say that word." The girl's eyes shone.
"What word? Sex?"
I put my hands over my ears.
"Gah!"
Molly grinned and enunciated.
"But the bleep part would make her lose control."
I coughed uncomfortably, lowering my hands. "Basically, yeah."
"Why don't you tie her up?"
I stared at the kid for a second. She lifted her eyebrows expectantly.
"What?"
I stammered.
"It's only practical," Molly stated firmly. "And hey, you've already got the handcuffs. If she can't move while the two of you are bleeping, she can't drink your blood, right?"
I stood up and started climbing down the ladder. "This conversation has become way too bleeping disturbing." Molly laughed at me, then followed me back to the ground. She unlocked the back door with another key, presumably from the same ring, and that was when Charity's light blue minivan turned into the driveway. Molly opened the door, darted into the house, and returned without her backpack. The minivan ground to a halt, and the engine died. Charity got out of the van, frowning at me and at Molly in more or less equal proportions. She wore jeans, hiking boots, and a heavy jacket. She was a tall woman, only an inch or so under 6 feet, and carried herself with an assurance that conveyed a sense of ready strength. Her face had the remote beauty of a marble statue, and her long blonde hair was knotted behind her head. Without being told, Molly went to the rolling side panel door, opened it, and reached inside, unloading children from safety seats, while Charity went to the rear of the van and opened the rear doors. "Mr. Dresden," she said, "lend a hand." I frowned.
"I'm sort of in a hurry. I was hoping to find Michael here."
Charity took a 24-pack of Coke from the van in one arm and a couple of bulging paper grocery sacks in the other. She marched over to me and shoved them at my chest. I had to fumble to catch them, and my blasting rod clattered to the ground. Charity waited until I had the sacks before heading for the van again.
"Put them on the table in the kitchen."
"But," I said. She walked past me toward the house. "I have ice cream melting, meat thawing, and a baby about to wake up hungry. Put them on the table and we'll talk." I sighed and looked glumly at the groceries. They were heavy enough to make my arms burn a little, which probably isn't saying much. I don't spend much time working out. Molly appeared from the van, lowering a tiny, tow-headed girl to the driveway. She was wearing a pink dress with a clashing orange sweater and bright purple shoes and a red coat. She walked up to me and said, words edged with babyish syllables,
"My name is Amanda. I am 5 and a half, and my daddy says I am a princess."
"I'm Harry, Your Highness," I said. She frowned and said,
"There's already a Harry. You can be Bill."
With that, she broke into a flouncing skip and followed her mother into the house.
"Well, I'm glad that's settled," I muttered.
Molly lowered an even smaller blonde girl to the driveway.
This one was dressed in blue overalls with a pink shirt and a pink coat. She held a plush dolly in one arm and a battered-looking pink blanket in the other. Upon seeing me, she retreated a couple of steps and hid around the corner of the van. She leaned out to look at me once and then hid again.
"I've got him," said an accented male voice.
Molly hopped out of the van, grabbed a grocery bag from the back, and said, "Come on, Hope." The little girl followed her big sister like a duckling while Molly went into the house, but Hope glanced back at me shyly three or four times on the way. Shiro emerged from the van carrying a baby seat. The little old knight carried the walking stick that concealed his sword on a strap over one wide shoulder, and his scarred hands held the chair carefully. A boy, probably not yet 2 years old, slept in it. "Little Harry?" I asked.
"Yes, Bill,"
Shiro said. His eyes sparkled behind his glasses. I frowned and said, "Good-looking kid."
"Dresden," snapped Charity's voice from the house. "You're holding the ice cream."
I scowled and told Shiro, "Guess we'd better get in." Shiro nodded wisely. I took the groceries into the carpenter's big kitchen and put them on the table. For the next 5 minutes, Shiro and Molly helped me carry in enough groceries to feed a Mongol horde. After all the perishables got put away, Charity fixed a bottle of formula and passed it off to Molly, who took it, a diaper bag, and the sleeping boy into another room. Charity waited until she had left, then shut the door.
"Very well," she said, still putting groceries away. "I haven't spoken to Michael since you called this morning. I left a message with his cell phone voicemail."
"Where is he?" I asked. Shiro laid his cane on the table and sat down.
"Mr. Dresden, we have asked you not to get involved in this business."
"That isn't why I'm here," I said. "I just need to talk to him."
"Why are you looking for him?" Shiro asked.
"I'm dueling a vampire under the Accords. I need a second before sundown or I get disqualified. Permanently." Shiro frowned.
"Red Court?"
"Yeah, some guy named Ortega."
"Heard of him," Shiro said. "Some kind of war leader."
I nodded. "That's the rumor. That's why I'm here. I had hoped Michael would be willing to help." Shiro stroked a thumb over the smooth old wood of his cane.
"We received word of Denarian activity near St. Louis. He and Sonya went to investigate."
"When will they get back?"
Shiro shook his head.
"I do not know."
I looked at the clock and bit my lip.
"Christ."
Charity walked by with an armload of groceries and glared at me. I lifted my hands.
"Sorry, I'm a little tense."
Shiro studied me for a moment and then asked,
"Would Michael help him?"
Charity's voice drifted out of the cavernous walk-in pantry.
"My husband is sometimes an idiot."
Shiro nodded and said,
"Then I will assist you in his stead, Mr. Dresden."
"You'll what?" I asked.
"I will be your second in the duel."
"You don't have to do that," I said. "I mean, I'll figure out something." Shiro lifted an eyebrow.
"Have the weapons been set for the duel?"
Not yet," I said.
"Then where is the meeting with the emissary and your opponent's second?"
I fished out the card I'd gotten from the archive. "I don't know. I was told to have my second call this number." Shiro took the card and rose without another word, heading for the phone in the next room. I put my hand on his arm and said, "You don't need to take any chances. You don't really know me."
"Michael does. That is enough for me."
The old knight's support was a relief, but I felt guilty somehow for accepting it. Too many people had been hurt on my behalf in the past. Michael and I had faced trouble together before, looked out for each other before. Somehow it made it easier for me to go to him to ask for help. Accepting the same thing from a stranger, Knight of the Cross or not, grated on my conscience, or maybe on my pride. But what choice did I have? I sighed and nodded. "I just don't want to drag someone else into more trouble with me." Charity muttered,
"Let me think. Where have I heard that before?"
Shiro smiled at her, the expression both paternal and amused, and said,
"I'll make the call."
I waited while Shiro made a call from the room that served as the family study and the office for Michael's contracting business. Charity stayed in the kitchen and wrestled a huge crockpot onto the counter. She got out a ton of vegetables, stew meat, and a spice rack, and set to chopping things up without a word to me. I watched her quietly. She moved with a kind of precision you only see in someone who is so versed at what they are doing that they are already thinking of the steps coming 20 minutes in the future. I thought she took her knife to the carrots a little more violently than she needed to. She started preparing another meal somewhere in the middle of making the stew. This one, chicken and rice and other healthy things I rarely saw in three dimensions. I fidgeted for a bit until I stood up, washed my hands in the sink, and started cutting vegetables. Charity frowned at me for a moment. She didn't say anything, but she got a few more veggies out and put them down next to me, then collected what had been cut so far and pitched them into the crock pot. A couple of minutes later, she sighed, opened a can of Coke, and put it on the counter next to me. "I worry about him," she said. I nodded and focused on cucumbers. "I don't even know when he'll be home tonight." "Good thing you have a crock pot," I said. "I don't know what I would do without him, what the children would do. I'd feel so lost." "What the hell?" An ounce of well-intentioned but irrational reassurance didn't cost anything. I took a sip of the Coke. "He'll be all right. He can handle himself. And he has Shiro and Sonya with him."
"He's been hurt 3 times, you know."
"3? I asked.
3. With you. Every time."
"So it's my fault. My turn to chop vegetables like teenagers in a slasher movie."
"I see."
I couldn't see her face, but her voice was, more than anything else, tired.
"It isn't about blame, or whose fault it is. All that matters is that when you're around, my husband, my children's father, gets hurt."
The knife slipped, and I cut off a neat little slice of skin on my index finger.
"Ow!"
I snarled. I slapped the cold water on in the sink and put my finger under it. You can't tell, with cuts like that, how bad they are going to be until you see how much they're leaking. Charity passed me a paper towel, and I examined the cut for a minute before wrapping the towel around it. It wasn't bad, though it hurt like hell. I watched my blood stain the paper towel for a minute, and then I asked,
"Why didn't you get rid of me, then?"
I looked up to see Charity frowning at me. There were dark circles under her eyes that I hadn't noticed before.
"What do you mean?"
"Just now," I said. "When Shiro asked if Michael would help me, you could have said no."
"But he would have helped you in an instant. You know that."
"Shiro didn't." Her expression became confused.
"I don't understand."
"You could have lied." Her face registered comprehension, and some fire came back into her eyes.
"I don't like you, Mr. Dresden. I certainly don't care enough for you to abandon beliefs I hold dear, to use you as an excuse to cheapen myself, or to betray what my husband stands for."
She stepped to a cabinet and got out a small, neat medical kit. Without another word, she took my hand and the paper towel and opened the kit.
"So you're taking care of me?" I asked. "I don't expect you to understand. Whether or not I can personally stand you, it has no bearing on what choices I make. Michael is your friend. He would risk his life for you. It would break his heart if you came to grief, and I will not allow that to happen."
She fell silent and doctored the cut with the same brisk, confident motions she'd used for cooking. I hear that they make disinfectants that don't hurt these days. But Charity used iodine. Chapter 16. Shiro came out of the office and showed me an address written on a piece of paper.
"We meet them tonight at 8.
"After sundown," I noted. "I know the place. I'll pick you up here."
"Yes. I will need a little time to prepare."
"Me too. Around 7. I told them goodbye and headed for the door. Charity didn't answer me, but Shiro did. I got into my car. More kids came pelting into the house as I did, 2 boys and a girl. The smaller of the 2 boys stopped to peer at my car, but Charity appeared in the door and chivied him inside. She frowned at me until I coaxed the blue beetle to life and pulled out. Driving home left me with too much time to think. This duel with Ortega was something I had no way to prepare for. Ortega was a warlord of the Red Court. He'd probably fought duels before, which meant that he'd killed people before. Hell, maybe even wizards. I'd squared off against various toughs, but that had been free-for-all.